It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As the record-long partial government shutdown continues, Congress and the White House remain at an impasse. The House has passed bipartisan bills that would reopen the government, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has yet to bring any of those bills to the floor. Congress might vote Thursday on two separate proposals, one by President Trump, one by House Democrats. Neither is expected to pass, and at this point, there's no end to the shutdown in sight. To talk more about what's happening in Washington, 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins spoke with Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Pat Toomey. She started by asking the Republican lawmaker what he makes of the latest developments.
Unfortunate doesn't even begin to capture. It's very frustrating. But while there's plenty of blame to go around, I really think that the fundamental problem here has been the unwillingness of Speaker Pelosi to engage in negotiations at all. It's always been clear to me that the president was open to negotiating the dollar amount. His initial position was $5.7 billion for physical border security. And her position was zero and she won't negotiate. And that's not reasonable.
There was a rally just outside of Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh International Airport on Friday to show support for the TSA officers who are working without a paycheck. And one thing that I heard a lot from people was that they said, you know, border security is important, but we need a paycheck. What do you make of the idea of reopening the government and then talking about a border wall?
Well, there's one problem with that, right? The president asked Speaker Pelosi point blank. He asked her, if we reopen the government, as you're demanding, if we do that, and then we begin negotiations, will you consider some funding for some physical border security then? And her answer was no. So what have we accomplished? You know, we're not going to get the border security piece of this, which is important, frankly, to most Americans. You know, I should point out, nobody's asking for a 2,000-mile-long continuous wall. We already have several hundred miles of the 2,000-mile border protected by physical barriers, and the Customs and Border Patrol folks tell us that we really should have some more in certain places. There are places where you don't need a border wall. If you've got mountainous terrain, you've got rivers, you have natural barriers. But there are other areas where maybe you have fairly dense population. You know, we've got towns that kind of run right up to the border on both sides or on either side. Well, it becomes very easy for someone to slip across the border and, you know, hide down an alley and disappear if there are no physical barriers in a location like that. For Speaker Pelosi to say it's immoral, it's ridiculous. It's obviously just a political motivation. So we're trying to break this impasse, break through this political mindset that some on the other side have, and that's what I'm hoping we can do this week.
In the Senate, just before Christmas, the Senate passed a continuing resolution to keep the government open, only to find out that President Trump wanted that legislation to include $5 billion for his wall. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell won't bring a bill like that to the floor now if the president doesn't announce that he supports it. And you have said in the past that Congress is elected separately from the president. Congress does not report to him. If Congress is an independent branch of government, how do you see Senator McConnell's decision to do this?
You know, Senator McConnell can make his decisions. He's the leader. My own view is we've got a bill that's going to be on the floor later this week if the Democrats allow us to take it up. I hope they will. I think it should be open to amendment. And those amendments could change it dramatically. I would like to include my provision, for instance, that would preclude future shutdowns. The president may or may not agree with those things, but the Senate should work its will.
I want to talk about gun control reform. You have backed some gun control measures in the past and indicated that you would be interested in doing something like that again after the Tree of Life shooting in October. I'm curious what the chances are of such legislation being more successful in 2019. What would it take for that sort of legislation to pass?
Well, let me be specific about what we're talking about here, because I'm a big believer in the Second Amendment. I'm a gun owner. I think the Second Amendment is a very, very important and individual right. Mm-hmm. My view has always been that that is not in conflict with my equally strongly held view that it is reasonable for us to do background checks on purchases, certainly commercial gun sales, because some people in our society don't have the right to the Second Amendment, specifically violent criminals who have demonstrated they don't deserve to have that right. People who are dangerously mentally ill, it is completely reasonable for us to prevent those people from having firearms. And so we need to have a mechanism for determining whether a person is in one of those two categories. The Sure. background check is the mechanism we've used, but there are loopholes. There are gaping holes in it. Sales at gun show on a large scale that really are equivalent to a commercial operation, those are not subject. Long gun sales in Pennsylvania are not subject to a background check. In other states, even handguns are not. Likewise, sales over the internet are not always subject to background checks. So my view is if there's commercial sales involved, there ought to be a background check. That's the legislation that I introduced with Senator Manchin. What are the prospects in 2019? The prospects have changed, perhaps, because the House has switched control. So I'm not happy about the fact that the House has changed control. I'm a Republican. I prefer Republican control. But the silver lining in that cloud, from my point of view, is that now we have a House that can pass broader background check legislation. I think they will do that. I think they will send it to the Senate. And if we can get a few more Republicans to take my view, which is that expanding background checks does not infringe on the rights of law-abiding citizens, then maybe we've got a shot at doing something here.
You have said that tariffs, specifically President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum, are just taxes that end up hurting American consumers. Do you think that we've been able to see the effect of his tariffs yet? Are they working? Are they doing what the president intended?
Have we seen the effects? Absolutely. I have a big stack on my desk of letters from Pennsylvania employers who have been very adversely affected by the tariffs. So the president's tariffs help you if you're in the business of making steel. But if you're one of the far more people who are employed in a company that uses steel and then you fabricate something or you convert it into another kind of steel or you change its form or shape, that's a much, much bigger industry in Pennsylvania and throughout America. And those folks are already being hurt. There is some danger that many of them will lose their jobs. So the adverse effect is absolutely happening. And, you know, the president's purpose in this was to pressure other countries, and specifically Canada and Mexico, to negotiate a new trade agreement. Well, for better or for worse, the Canadians and the Mexicans have done that. They've agreed to a new trade agreement. And the administration was supposed to lift these tariffs when an agreement was reached. It has been reached, and they still haven't lifted the tariffs. So it's frustrating to me, and it's harmful. And it's simply a factual matter that a tariff is a tax on American consumers. The president likes to brag about how many billions of dollars are coming into the Treasury. Well, they're all coming out of American wallets.
You have had some tough words for Saudi Arabia after the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. I'm curious, what do you think should be done to call that country's leadership to account, and what is likely to happen?
I think this administration didn't handle that situation well. You know, unfortunately, it's true there are many regimes around the world that commit atrocities, including murdering some of their own people, including murdering their dissidents. That doesn't make it okay, and it certainly doesn't make it okay for our allies. We do expect more from our allies, and Saudi Arabia has been an ally. So I think there are a variety of ways we can send the message to the Saudi government that that is completely unacceptable. A temporary suspension of weapons sales, for instance, would be just one of many ways that we could convey that message. It's difficult because there's a reason that we are allied with Saudi Arabia, and it's because our two countries share common security interests. And Saudi Arabia is the most significant counterweight to Iran in the Middle East, and Iran is extremely hostile to the United States and our interests, but it's problematic when their government goes off the rails, as they did in the case of the assassination of Khashoggi. So I think we need to strike the right balance. It is not the case that we should suddenly no longer consider this country, Saudi Arabia, to be an ally, but it is the case that we need to send a very strong message to their leadership that that behavior was completely unacceptable.
You ran in 2016 as a check on President Trump. Obviously, you know, you are critical of the way that the administration handled the death of Khashoggi. Are there other examples that point to your leadership as a check on the president?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, that example is one. I was very outspoken and critical of the president's decision to suddenly withdraw from Syria. I think that's destabilizing. I have been probably the most outspoken Republican opponent of the president's tariff policy and leading efforts to push back on that in a variety of ways. So, you know, look, when the president pursues policies that I agree with, then I'm going to support the president. When he does things I disagree with, I've pushed back very aggressively. I don't think it's my job to monitor and play running commentary on the president's Twitter feed, but it is my responsibility to stand up for Pennsylvania. And so when the president and I disagree, on substantive policy matters, you know, I'll say so, and I have.
Senator Toomey, thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins speaking with Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Harris Wofford, civil rights activist, university president, former U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, died Monday on Martin Luther King Jr. Day at age 92. Joining me to reflect on the contributions of Senator Wofford is the man who now holds that same Senate seat, Senator Bob Casey. Senator, thanks so much for taking the time.
Kevin, great to be with you. Thank you.
Senator, you first got to know Harris Wofford through your late father, Governor Bob Casey Sr. They were friends. What were your early impressions?
Well, I got to know Harris first. I guess I think I had met him in the 70s when I was growing up, but I remember meeting him and spending a lot more time with him in 1986 when my father was running for, believe it or not, his fourth time running for governor. And Harris was an old friend from the 1950s, actually. They met as young lawyers in Washington and then stayed in touch over the years, but really worked together in that 1986 campaign. Harris, after the primary election that year, became the state party chair and then served as the State Secretary of Labor and Industry, as they call that department,
right,
under in my father's first term as governor, and then, of course, was appointed to the Senate in 1991 after the tragic death of Senator John Hines.
Right.
So in those years, when he was in the campaign, in state government, and thereafter, is when I got to know him.
Right. He had such a wide-ranging career. He marched with Dr. King in the civil and voting rights demonstrations in Selma. He was President Kennedy's special assistant for civil rights, helped create the Peace Corps. As you mentioned, he was Secretary of Labor and Industry in your father's administration and was appointed as U.S. Senator following the death of Senator John Hines. Where do you think Harris Wofford made his biggest impact?
Well, I guess I'd have to say civil rights. If I were, and I'm not, certainly not a historian, but if you had to narrow it down to one issue, I'd probably say that, because he was not just part of a larger effort. He was one of the leaders who really was committed to it, stuck his neck out, like a lot of people, starting with Dr. King and all the people that worked with him. At times, having to put your life at risk, or at least take a risk, because of all the violence that was so much a part of the opposition to civil rights, the opposition to desegregation, the opposition to marching forward. So, because of Harris's commitment to justice and equal rights and equal opportunity, he put himself at risk, and it certainly wasn't going to make him any money. He was so committed to those issues and so committed to serving others that he worked very hard on civil rights. And as you know, one of the hallmarks of Dr. King's civil rights achievements was nonviolence, which is easy to talk about and really difficult to do, because it's pretty difficult when someone is screaming at you or bringing harm to you. Pretty difficult to maintain your composure and to keep marching forward. And that nonviolence characteristic of that movement was first introduced by Gandhi. And, of course, Harris Wofford not only knew Dr. King and John and Robert Kennedy, but he was also studied under and learned from Mahatma Gandhi in India. So it's he made a substantial and enduring contribution to civil rights, both as an activist and friend of Dr. King, but then also as a campaign advisor and then special assistant to President Kennedy on civil rights.
Was Harris Wofford an influence on you? Obviously, you leaned on your father for counsel. But did you also tap the wisdom of Senator Wofford?
I did. Actually, I can honestly say he inspired me before I knew him. Because one of the things my father, because they were friends, my father was sent a book that Harris wrote in the 1970s into 1980. I think it was published in 1980. And I'd recommend it to anyone. The name of the book is Of Kennedys and Kings. And then the subtitle is Making Sense of the 60s. He wrote that in 1980, sent it to my father with an inscription. My father showed it to me, and I grabbed it and read it. And I was in college at the time. I was, I guess, between my maybe sophomore and junior in college. I read it that summer, and really curious about that history, the history of the 60s seen through the eyes of someone who lived a lot of the history. But I was also inspired by his clarion call to serve. Harris was passionate about a lot of things, and one of the passions he had was service. He really believed that everyone should figure out a way to serve the country in some fashion, kind of living up to the words of Dr. King, where Dr. King once said, everyone can be great because everyone can serve, and meaning that service was a kind of greatness, not for acclaim and for notoriety, but it made you a better person. So his description in that book about the Peace Corps and about service and all the things he did inspired me when I was in college. And then I had the chance to work with him years later.
Senator Bob Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it.
Governor Tom Wolf issued a statement saying, quote, Harris represented the best of Pennsylvania and America, a selfless, empathetic, and optimistic citizen. We will be forever indebted for his service to us, end quote. The governor has ordered the Commonwealth flag at all Commonwealth facilities and all public buildings and grounds throughout the state to fly at half staff to honor former Senator Harris Wofford. Harris Wofford is survived by his husband, Charlton, as well as his three children and six grandchildren. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You've been hearing a lot about how the Trump administration wants to roll back environmental regulations. WHYY's Susan Phillips takes us inside a sewage treatment plant to look at how one law, the Clean Water Act, turned the Delaware River near Philadelphia from a stinking sewer into a robust resource.
In the first part of this series, we learned how polluted the Delaware River was in the decades leading up to the passage of the Clean Water Act. Shipping vessels refused to dock because it smelled so bad. Hydrogen sulfide fumes turned the hulls of ships black. Dead fish washed up on the banks of the river.
So it was a stinky, ugly mess.
That's Deb McCarty, Philadelphia's current water commissioner. She's in charge of a system that now treats between 500 million and 1 billion gallons of wastewater each day. But before the Clean Water Act passed in the early 1970s, that sewage didn't get treated very well, and it ran right into the river. McCarty is taking me on a tour of the Southwest Philadelphia Treatment Plant. It sits right beside the airport, along the Delaware River. She points to a brick building built in the 1920s.
Originally, that pumping station, all it did was pump it to the river.
Oh,
initially.
Really? Was it raw sewage going into
yeah.
the river?
Yeah. Yes.
So what did that do to the river?
It made the river stink and makes it so fish and other critters can't survive. There's not enough oxygen in that water for them to thrive.
In the 1960s, dissolved oxygen levels in parts of the Delaware River around Philadelphia were zero. So the fish couldn't breathe. And fishermen weren't catching any fish. But this year, some Delaware River fishermen say they've had one of their best years yet for catching shad. So how did that happen? The quick answer, regulation. The Clean Water Act was a giant set of regulations that forced cities like Philadelphia to stop channeling waste into rivers. When Congress passed it in 1972, the law provided both carrot and stick. It set limits on what could be discharged into waterways, imposed fines on violators, implemented a permit system, and it also provided money for sewage treatment upgrades so cities like Philadelphia could meet those new regulations.
Here's Philly sitting at that time with two major wastewater treatment plants that just frankly weren't very good.
Rich Pepino worked for the EPA at the time. He helped enforce the new law. Standing along the Delaware River today, Pepino says the city's waterfront would not exist without the Clean Water Act.
Along comes the federal government with this big check and says, we'll let you upgrade these, which is the thing that gives us this today.
Today, the river looks very different. The hulls of boats no longer turn black. There are pleasure boats, kayakers, fishermen, and festivals, yoga classes, and beer gardens, along with million-dollar houses lining what was, just 40 years ago, a dead, disgusting river. Water Commissioner Deb McCarty says the federal government gave the city millions of dollars to modernize its three treatment plants.
Just think of that, $900 million in the late 70s through the 80s. That's a lot of money.
It was a massive building project, but it didn't happen overnight. And it was up to people like Bob Serpenti to figure it out.
So we were like, okay, let's go. What are we going to do today?
Serpenti was in charge of this sewage treatment plant in southwest Philadelphia in the early 1970s. And he joined us for the tour. When he started working here, he didn't even have a calculator. But everything changed after the Clean Water Act passed.
And we had a small crew of young engineers and old mechanics and operators, and we just threw ourselves at it. It was amazing.
Serpenti and McCarty explain that back in the 1970s, treatment at this plant was pretty simple. Gravity separated the raw sewage. Solids, or sludge, settled to the bottom of a big tank, while scum, which includes grease, rose to the top and got skimmed off.
And it is the most disgusting stuff we handle. Sludge is nothing. Scum is disgusting.
At that time, the scum and the sludge, the most concentrated solid waste, went into nearby lagoons, or it was dumped out in the ocean. But the remaining liquid ended up in the Delaware River untreated. Looking at brown, murky water partway through the tour, McCarty shows just how bad things used to be.
This is it. This is what we did until the Clean Water Act.
Before the Clean Water Act, this water right here would go into the river.
Right.
To clean up the rivers, the Clean Water Act ushered in an age of biological science to treat wastewater. Standing by large tanks, McCarty explains how today, before any liquid waste gets into the river, they add oxygen and microbes.
Now you want to basically get them fat and happy in here. So you're feeding them oxygen, so they're thriving. They're like, this is great, I can breathe. And creating the ideal environment for these critters to eat those pollutants.
Once the microbes eat the pollutants, the liquid goes out into another tank where any remaining solids settle out. After this stage, the liquid waste looks like clear water.
My goodness, it's like probably 2 milligrams per liter suspended solids. This is excellent. It is excellent. Our limit is 30.
Add in some chlorine, and the sewage water that goes into the river today is a lot cleaner and meets standards higher than what the Clean Water Act requires. Deb McCarty, Bob Serpenti, and the EPA's Rich Pepino say they're proud of what they did to improve the health of the river. And although it took years, they say the Clean Water Act is a piece of regulation that worked. But at a time when the Trump administration wants to roll back regulations, Pepino says laws like the Clean Water Act actually need updated.
I'm proud for my years of EPA, but I just don't want us to sit on our laurels and say the job is done.
It doesn't stink, and dead fish aren't washing up on the riverbanks. But the Delaware River now faces new challenges from emerging pollutants like plastics, pharmaceuticals, impacts of climate change, all of which go unregulated. Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
You're listening to The Confluence.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. The line between teacher and student can gray, especially as those students find their own professional success. That's certainly been the case for a pair of colleagues who met in the classroom at the University of Pittsburgh. Siobhan Vivian is an author and editor. She leads two courses at the University of Pittsburgh on young adult fiction, and it was in that Oakland classroom where she met Rachel Lippincott. Rachel's first novel, 5 Feet Apart, was released in November and jumped straight to the New York Times bestseller list. Welcome, both of you, to The Confluence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
First off, Rachel, congratulations.
Thank you. Oh, man.
Tell us a little bit about the book and how it came to be.
Absolutely. 5 Feet Apart is about two teens with cystic fibrosis, Will and Stella, and they fall in love, but it's complicated by the fact that they can't be closer than 6 feet apart from each other. So this creates this really interesting dynamic where they realize that they're falling for one another but can't get close enough to touch, which is really interesting. So this came to be because I did meet Siobhan. She called me one day, I think back in February, and said that she saw that there was this position to take the screenplay for 5 Feet Apart, which was written by Mickey Daughtry and Tobias Iaconis, and turn it into a book. So we worked together to kind of put together a first chapter, and I sent that in, and I got the job, which was incredible. And so over the course of the next 5 months, from about March to August, I wrote the book, which was amazing.
That tryout process is really unique to the publishing industry. Siobhan, can you explain a little bit what that looks like and kind of how sampling works?
Yeah, the sampling process is something unique to properties that maybe have source material behind them. And in the case of Rachel's project, there was a pre-existing screenplay, and then her job was to dramatize it for fiction. And it's not as simple as, you know, just describing a room. In fact, I think in Rachel's case, she had to create an entirely different identity and voice for a character that is not featured in the movie adaptation. So it was just a process of reading the screenplay and, making it into fiction.
We mentioned the term young adult fiction a couple of times here. Siobhan, maybe you can tell us, what exactly does that mean in terms of the realm of publishing?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked. I can't tell you how many times at my own book signings that I will have an adult come up to me and sort of sometimes with a little bit of embarrassment or even sometimes like a little bit of shame admit that they have read and loved one of my books. And, you know, I'm so quick to say, no, you know, young adult doesn't necessarily mean for teens. It's for everyone. And really the main distinction of what a young adult novel is that it features a protagonist living their youth. So, oftentimes adult novels will feature teen protagonists, but, you know, their experiences have that sort of glaze of reflection upon them. So it's an older person recounting their teen years. But in the case of young adult, we're just in the thick of it. And again, that doesn't mean that it's not for everyone. It very much is.
Rachel, you're nodding a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. After 5 Feet Apart was published, one of the first people that actually called me was this 80-year-old father figure from back home. And he just was talking about the book, and he told me that he cried on multiple occasions while reading it. And I think that's just really something that's very important about, you know, young adult novels, is that they do have the ability to kind of span these generations, a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old, but also, you know, a 60-year-old or an 80-year-old man from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, can all have these like really emotional and just like wonderful reactions to what they're reading, which I think is really special.
Do you think young adult fiction gets the same level of respect as other forms of writing in the publishing industry?
I mean, by those who actively read it, yes. I think sometimes it's very easy in the abstract to marginalize our experiences as teenagers. You know, especially as an adult, you often think like, oh my gosh, why was I so crazy in high school? Why did I care so much about the things that people said to me? I haven't talked to that person in 20 years, you know? But when you're living in it, I mean, it is so emotional and fraught and pure. And, you know, those are really excellent emotions to bring into a piece of fiction. And so, unfortunately, I think sometimes young adult gets cast with a lens that, you know, adult fiction maybe doesn't. There is certainly the more pop, you know, candy, romancy, you know, adult fiction that you'd buy in paperback at a supermarket. But then there's also the beautiful hardcover, literary, challenging, nuanced stories. And young adult has that same breadth.
So 5 Feet Apart gets published. Siobhan, you played a pretty big role in kind of making all of this happen. Explain to us kind of how you were able to draw that connection.
Well, you know, I did meet Rachel. She took my young adult writing class at the University of Pittsburgh. And, you know, it was very clear to me immediately how talented she was and how much I enjoyed working with her. You know, and we stayed in close touch throughout her time at Pitt. And when this opportunity came to me to recommend somebody for this project, I immediately thought of Rachel because I just knew she would get it. She could be funny, she could be heartfelt. You know, it's a tricky balance. And, you know, also I'll say that I know she's a really hard worker and I knew it was a tight turnaround. So, you know, it made it a no-brainer to kind of throw her name into the mix. But honestly, after that, I stepped away and, you know, Rachel is no longer my student, my former student. She's my colleague and my peer. And, you know, I respected her writing then, and I will continue to. And I love that we can still sort of work together now as peers. But, you know, it was wonderful to sit and watch her just soar with this opportunity.
Rachel, you're blushing just a bit.
I am blushing very hard over here, yeah.
How valuable to both of you are connections like that? You know, just thinking about it in terms of journalism, having an editor's name or contact information can be gold. What is that like in the book industry?
Oh, my goodness. I would say it's the most valuable. I do not know where I would be, honestly, without Siobhan's mentorship, and I can say that with my entire heart. Yeah, I don't know. I think Siobhan really put me on the path of writing. I always really wanted to be a writer. And I know going into Pitt, I was not on that track. And because of Siobhan's class and her mentorship, I really, you know, took the leap and decided to go for it. I would have not heard about this opportunity. I don't know if I would have necessarily ever had the guts to finish a book and get published if it wasn't for Siobhan, you know, showing me the ropes.
Nice. I feel like, you know, in the course of my career, so many people extended themselves on my behalf. And, you know, I'm so glad to have had the opportunity with Rachel and other former students to try to connect them to my contacts in the publishing industry, because it's a huge leg up. And, you know, I feel like I'm paying it forward in that way.
And Rachel, you mentioned that writing was not necessarily your first choice. You were pre-med, is that right?
I was, yeah, going into Pitt.
What happened?
That's a great question. I honestly, for as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be a writer. I used to like, do you remember the Cam Jensen series she had? Yeah. Oh, man. And then also like Amelia Bedelia, like they both had like notebooks and they were always writing stuff. And that was literally me. I just carried a notebook wherever I went. And then I think by the time I got to college, I just decided to do pre-med, which is not like obviously not a failing, but I think I just for a while was going on that track. And it wasn't really until taking Siobhan's class that I rekindled this interest in writing. And then also in taking the second class, I proceeded to just drop all my science classes and go for English writing as my major, which was a wild experience.
What were those classes? You said two sections of young adult writing. What were those classes like? What did it feel like in the classroom?
Well, first of all, Siobhan's hilarious. So I think
she's taking you very seriously.
Yeah, the second you come into the classroom and you sit down for the normal boring syllabus spiel, Siobhan makes it probably one of the funniest comedic routines you've ever seen. So right from the start, you automatically know the teacher is going to be great. Which I think is really important stepping into a classroom. But for the workshops themselves, I don't think I've ever met anyone who has the ability to really see a story, no matter whose story it is, whatever workshop piece is brought in, and really, you know, be able to flesh it out and really make it into something wonderful. And I think Siobhan, every single class, every single student, she was able to just bring about these really wonderful ideas and just really inspire whoever's story it was to just keep writing and keep going for it, which I think was really great. So the first class was predominantly that. It was, you know, working in workshops. Somebody would bring in a piece every week and we would all workshop together. And then the second class, I think, is really what prepared everybody to be a writer. And writing youth lit too, we would write 3,000 words a week and bring it in and workshop it. And then on top of that, Siobhan's giving us great advice, like how to write a query letter and, you know, how to like talk to an agent and how to plot out your story in a successful format instead of just, you know, writing by the seat of your pants forever, which is definitely a fault of mine. So it was just really interesting to be able to, you know, sit down in this class and not only become a better writer, but then also kind of gain experience to actually be a writer.
And 3,000 words a week, that's no small feat.
It's not. But, you know, the practice of writing a first draft is a hurdle that is very hard to cross. And it's, I think of it as a full body workout for writers. You know, you can hide a lot of bad writing in 10 or 15 pages. But when you have to string an entire story together, it's about character development, plot, pacing, you know, all of that stuff. It helps prepare students for what I think is one of the biggest challenges of being a writer, which is that oftentimes it's hard and it doesn't feel good and you don't know what you're doing, but you have to work through that. You have to keep writing. If you want to be a writer, you have to find a way to sit with that uncomfortable feeling and just keep going. So, and for that class specifically, I really don't care what you write for those 3,000 words. I'm not going to worry about if this is the prettiest sentence I've ever read. I'm just cheering you on, and you know, we're getting blood from a stone, basically.
I was about to say, that's the kind of firm encouragement I would expect from an editor.
Well, and that's honestly what brought me to Pitt. You know, I teach my two weird classes because I miss being an editor. I love figuring out the puzzle of story, you know, if it's a contemporary story, a love story, a science fiction story, you know, that's really fun to work on the puzzle of that. And that is why I teach. So, you know, I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to do that and scratch that itch here at Pitt and, you know, and discover these amazing talents while I'm at it.
So you're both best-selling authors now. Success like that can be kind of like the dream, right? But at what point does that put more pressure on you for whatever's coming next?
I've tried to warn Rachel a little bit about that because, you know, to have such success out of the gate is thrilling, but it can be crippling. And so, you know, I am definitely here to hold her hand and help her sort of get that second book together and out. And oftentimes, you know, that's challenging for anyone. But she should view all of the success that's come her way as just an asset. And, you know, that has just given her, like I said, a huge leg up. And nothing but good things can come from that. So just leaning into the positives of that experience and not trying to worry too much about duplicating that success.
Rachel, is that feeding your soul right
now?
Oh
my gosh, you have no idea. I need to just record that and like play it back to myself at like 4 a.m. when I'm like, when will the next book be done?
Lucky this is radio.
Yeah, that's great. Absolutely. I think for me, it's been a little bit intimidating. I think especially like seeing the book make the list now for the sixth week, I was just like, I really need to, you know, get something out. I think it's definitely what Siobhan says. It's an asset. And if I continue looking at it like that, then, you know, it's only good things ahead.
So what is next for both of you?
I am finishing up on my 10th young adult novel.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's called We Are the Wildcats, and it is slated for spring of 2020.
And Rachel?
I'm currently working on a first draft of a young adult contemporary novel, and Siobhan's helping me with that.
Best of luck to both of
Thanks.
You.
Thanks.
Rachel Lippincott graduated from the University of Pittsburgh in December of 2017. Her first book, 5 Feet Apart, is out now, and the accompanying film is in theaters in March. Siobhan Vivian is a teacher, writer, and editor of young adult fiction with Simon & Schuster. Her books have been translated in more than 10 countries worldwide, and her latest novel, Stay Sweet, is out now. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the state system of higher education is 36 years old. Leadership is looking to restructure and strengthen the system to allow students greater access to classes at any of the schools while still preserving each of the 14 universities. We'll have a conversation with the new chancellor, Daniel Greenstein. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, plus Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.